Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to a new episode of Constructive Criticism. I'm your host, Spencer. I'm joined by my co-host, a man who just loves spending time with me every Monday, Michael Hinderacher.
But only over the internet.
That's rude.
Well, I mean, it does seem to be the pattern lately.
Well, I mean, I live far away now.
Yeah. No, the actual secret is that no one wants to drive to Lehigh. Which
that's
I believe is your catchphrase.
That's not my catchphrase.
I don't know. I vaguely remember some trip where you said that like 25 times.
I remember you guys saying it 25 times after I said it once. It was definitely a them thing, not a me.
You don't get to choose your own catchphrase. It happens. It's like a nickname.
I haven't heard that one. But you know who you can always choose is our sponsor at Oasis Games. You can check them out at mtgoasis.com. You can get 15% off your first order by using the code CCMTG at checkout. And you can get 4% off of every order by using the code Would That Be Good? No spaces. They are an amazing place to buy magic cards. Mason bought some Freaking Afflictions for $1,000 this week, which is pretty powerful. You can also buy them for less, you know, like 75 cents. But, you know, Mason, he's a high roller. High roller wants those foil
just
ones.
Just a generous guy.
Yeah. The bug got him. But you can also check out our other sponsor, the Manabase. You can get you can check out all of their amazing content creators, like Nikachu, who, as we all know, this week was informed about Mason calling him out on our podcast, and I got to listen to that. So if you're listening, Nikachu, you let me know when the grudge match is going to happen. We'll start accepting bets. I think Nikachu's like probably 40-1 favorite over Mason at this point in his life. So, you know, whatever. But the
real question is, did the random person on Twitter that Mason called out respond?
I don't think so.
Because that would be way better. Oh, it got you a Twitter follower. Oh, I mean, Mason just told us that it actually earned him a Twitter follower. So I think that, frankly, that's a good transaction.
Yeah, you just threaten random people on Twitter and they're going to follow you. but you know who you don't have to threaten is the other content creators at the Manabase or their sponsor at Fusion Gaming. So check out Fusion Gaming for all of your Sealed product needs and check out the Manabase for some other amazing content. You can also support this podcast directly by going to Patreon, patreon.com/CCMTG, to become a patron of this show, any amount that you see fit. In fact, if every listener of this podcast donated just $1, Michael, just $1, we could quit our jobs. And the reason that that's still true is because Patreon didn't get rid or didn't make the changes that they said they were going to.
Yeah, they ended up deciding that was not a great idea because it wasn't.
Yeah, so they apologized and said, never mind. So if you are interested in becoming a patron, go to patreon.com/CCMTG. I'm taking almost all of next week off of work, and I will be changing the Patreon to reflect kind of where the podcast is at. The Patreon was created 3 years ago, and a lot has changed in that time. I have a one-year-old. I have a new co-host. I'm 3 years deeper into my marriage. With? You weren't on the podcast 3 years ago.
I know. I'm.
Oh, okay.
Just not really that new at this point. A new old co-host.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But there's going to be some changes. There's a post there right now where if you are a patron, you're welcome to go and tell us the kind of things that you look for from us as extra benefits. You know, some of the things were really popular when we started out and aren't feasible anymore. Some of them weren't very popular and so on and so forth. So we just kind of want to see what you guys want and get your feedback. So everything that you can tell us is appreciated, but you can kind of look for an update coming here this week. One of the benefits that will likely stay, it will stay, is our patron participation segment where we invite our patrons to ask us a question. Michael, why don't you go ahead and read this week's question?
So basically this week's question is just asking how you handle Rust in eternal constructed formats like Modern or Legacy. And basically they're saying they haven't played much since Grand Prix Vegas, might be playing either the main event or side events at GP Santa Clara, and they have decks. Basically what they're saying is that they don't really want us to just talk about the decks that they have, but sort of how you look at maybe metagames and updating your decks and how you just sort of get back in the flow of playing.
Yeah. I think that one thing that is so awesome today is you can usually find a modern event really close to you, just to jam in a few games before any given Grand Prix. It's really easy, even if you're not a Modo player, which it makes it even easier, right? You can just go on and jam a league or two. Modern is luckily really, really easy to jam games for. You can go make some changes that you think might work, go jam games at a local event, and it's really quick feedback loop for you because of how popular Modern has gotten. And it's a really good way to shake the rust off, just going to one or two events, getting a feel, and then doing a little bit of studying, kind of looking at what's going on in Modern today, what are people playing, what kind of sideboard cards can you expect to see? Because one thing that is really important as Modern is those sideboards. So if you get a chance to kind of go through deck lists and see what people could reasonably bring in against you, it's going to give you an advantage that I don't know that we had or that we have in any other format.
Yeah, I think it's nice to just, like, get some paper reps in with the deck. I think just, like, physically... something about just, like, physically shuffling the cards and getting to sit down and play, sort of... If it's been a while since you've just played, I think it can be helpful just to sort of get in the headspace of how Paper Magic works again.
Yeah.
As far as shaking off Rust, I think that for both Legacy and Modern, I kind of like looking at, well, maybe Modern more than Legacy. I like looking at sort of like MTG Goldfish results, things like that, just sort of trying to get a feel for what is popular right now. Because I think in Modern especially, people have enough deck mobility that the popular decks at a Grand Prix are likely to be similar to the popular decks online. Yeah. So I think as far as just having sort of an idea of like where your deck is in the metagame, there are really good resources online. A lot of the time, if your list is older, you can find more current lists. So, you know, maybe you still want to play the same deck as before, but like you might want to update your sideboard or make a couple of changes to some slots or stuff like that. With Legacy, I think that in general, the online metagame is a little more condensed than the paper metagame is. That's just been my experience, that in paper you tend to play against a little bit more kind of random stuff, especially at like a Grand Prix, compared to what you'd play against online. But other than that, I really think that looking at like online lists is a really good starting place.
Yeah, I think so too. That's exactly where I would start in trying to kind of just get into an idea of what you could reasonably play against.
Yeah, and I think then, like, if you don't have a ton of time to actually play a huge amount of matches, I think that just making sure that you're spending your time in a productive way is really important. I think looking at some of these lists and kind of getting an idea of why, maybe trying to spend some time thinking about why cards are what they are in these sideboards or stuff like that. Like, if you can figure out why cards are there, you're much more likely to, you know, be able to use them correctly and sideboard in a way that's helpful.
And luckily, because of the decks that this listener is playing, there's probably also a lot of video content that he can kind of just have on in the background and kind of listen to people as they go through their thought processes also, if they don't have to go out.
Yeah, I think a lot of it too, though, is like you can do a lot of work in terms of preparing yourself mentally without actually playing a ton of games.
So I hope that answers your question. I do think that kind of what we said at the beginning, that if you do have a way to get into some paper events, just those solid start, like those solid gameplay actions that you get from just playing in a paper event is probably going to be really helpful for you if you can before the Grand Prix starts.
I agree. Just getting used to sort of what paper magic feels like again.
Yep.
Yep.
Well, let's go on to our next segment, which is hashtag always improving. Hashtag always improving is the point of this podcast. We believe if you're not getting better, you're getting worse. And we want to be doing what we can all the time to be improving ourselves. You know, whether it's in magic or in life, it's important to just take an active role in your own improvement. Michael, what have you done this week to improve at magic or life in general?
I've just been trying to grind away at Modern a little bit. With Pro Tour coming up sort of soon and Santa Clara before then, I've been trying to help Matt choose a deck for that and just just sort of trying to make sure that I don't leave stones unturned. And I think that especially in modern, one of the things that sometimes is more, so like sometimes you'll have a deck where you're pretty sure it's not great. Like either it hasn't put up results or just you can look at it and you're just like, oh, I don't really think this deck is for me, or I don't think this deck is that good. But I think if you play it or watch someone else play it or read about it or try to find out like where the deck might be good and why someone might play it and what their game plan looks like, even if you end up deciding not to play it, I think that that information is really helpful in terms of kind of piecing out what you might expect to play against and why you might expect to play against it. And if you do, how to, like, what you're trying to do.
Yeah. So for me, I just was, somebody posted a question in our Facebook group about articles that helped with control. And it brought me back to some of the level one articles written by Reed Duke on the Mothership. So I downloaded all of those to my phone as audio files through an app I use called Audiofy that basically turns articles into podcasts, and I've been re-listening to them. And it's honestly been really cool, kind of revisiting really, really basic strategies, for me at least, in Magic, and kind of just giving myself a refresher course every morning on my way to work has been really nice.
Yeah, I think just sometimes, like, removing yourself from what you've been focused on lately and just trying to sort of back up a little bit can be really helpful and help make things less stressful and overwhelming.
Yeah, I think so too. I think that oftentimes we get so focused on trying to get better and better and better and better that we start to ignore the things that got us to where we're at in the first place. And I just kind of want to give myself a little bit of a chance to not have that happen to me. I don't know.
Yeah, I think just sometimes moving your focus back a little bit where it's to broader things rather than narrower things helps you just approach the game in a different way. And I think that can be really helpful.
Absolutely. So, Michael, let's move on to our deck doctor. So every week on the show, we invite our patrons of $5 or more per month, our, as we like to call them, our constructed critics. We like to invite them to submit a deck for our deck doctor segment, where we talk about what we love, what we would change, and where we think the deck might stand today. And Michael is not a fan of the strategy that we're talking about today. Michael, we are going to talk about Blood Moon control decks. So why don't you go ahead and read off this list for us?
Yeah, so this is Blue-Red, Kiki Moon, and you've probably seen like the Blue-Red Breach decks as well, but they're pretty similar. So 2 Blood Moon, 1 Spreading Seas, 4 Snapcaster Mage, 1 Vendilion Click, 2 Deceiver Exarch, 3 Pestermite, 2 Kiki Jiki, 4 Lightning Bolt, 4 Opt, 4 Serum Visions, 2 Spell Snare, 1 Harvest Pyre, 4 Remand, 2 Electrolyze, 2 Cryptic Command, 8 Fetch Lands, 7 Islands, a Mountain, 2 Steam Vents, 2 Sulfur Falls, a Cascade Bluffs, a Desolate Lighthouse, and in the sideboard, 2 Abrade, 3 Anger of the Gods, 3 Dispel, 2 Engineered Explosives, 1 Keranos, 2 PN Kieran Nalar, and 2 Vidalkin Shackles.
Okay. So, we'll get into Michael not liking these archetypes during the where we think this deck stands. Let's start with the things that we like about this deck. This is a weird thing I never thought that I would have to say, but I actually really like where Remand is in Modern right now. Go ahead.
Yeah, it feels like it had kind of fallen out of favor for a while, but I think that it's in a reasonable spot. I very much like Spell Snare and Harvest Fire as well, and I like not playing 4 Cryptic Commands. Because I've played a bunch of these decks with just, you can just tell it's too many. 4 is many Cryptic Commands.
I think so too. I like that it's not playing 4 Cryptics. I really also have felt like this deck, like this archetype, this Kiki, Jiki, Pestermite, Deceiver Exarch thing, has been underutilized in Modern since the Splinter Twin banning. And I think that it is a nice control finisher. I think that one thing that I do worry about with this, though, is really it's light on everything is something that I kind of worry about. Like, it's light on Kiki Jiggins, it's light on Blood Moons. So it just becomes this really hard to have a very narrow game control deck. Like, it doesn't do anything particularly well from what I'm seeing.
I think that might be true. One thing I do like, actually, about this versus, like, Through the Breach is that Kiki Jiki is actually... It doesn't die to as much as it probably has at most points in Modern's history. Like, just actually the fact that
there's
there
just
are
less
very few lightning bolts and it specifically doesn't die to Fatal Push is actually pretty powerful.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously they can Fatal Push your other thing, but, like, you know, Kiki Jiki being in play is the harder part of the combo generally. So I do think Kiki Jiki will probably die a lot less than it would have in the past.
Yeah. One thing that one of the people in chat pointed out is the Harvest Fire. I also really like Harvest Fire just as, like, a really clean removal spell for a lot of things in the format. But on the same note, I am a little confused by some of the numbers. You know, the number of Spreading Seeds is a little bit surprising to me. I don't know. This is interesting. I feel like one of the hard things when you're doing something like a deck doctor can be that this person has created this deck and they are going to have reasons for a lot of the things that we might be confused about.
Yeah, so my thought is that playing, like, the main deck Vendilion Click, the split that favors Pestermite over Deceiver Exarch, and then, like, the four-bolt Snapcaster thing is that this deck is much more able to actually just win by attacking than, like, the Breach versions of this deck, and that is
right.
Probably why they're playing less Kiki Jikis in particular. Like, I would imagine this deck has a much better Death Shadow matchup than the Breach deck does, likely because Pestermite as a tempo play is actually relatively potent at times, and a deck going really low on life, the Lightning Bolts are actually, like, much more likely to be valid in this kind of strategy.
Yeah, that's true. You get, and I mean, as you can see from the number of Snapcasters being played, it definitely is leaning towards that.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that you can't play more Harvest Pyres, but I don't think you really can in a four Snapcaster Mage deck. Especially with this many permanents. Like, this is a lot of permanents for a control deck with the like three land hate effects plus 12 creatures. So you're, like, pretty heavy on permanents.
And what do you think is the reason to have that be a Spreading Seas over a
Blood Moon? I could see it having to do with total number of three drops.
Sure.
I think Spreading Seas is also a little bit more of a hedge card in general. Like, it's sure. Not as good as Blood Moon, but it's sort of thematically similar. And having it cantrip is not nothing, because there are definitely matchups where Blood Moon just isn't very good, and in those matchups you'd obviously much rather draw a single Spreading Seas.
So as you try and prepare for this Pro Tour, Michael, where do these Blood Moon style control decks sit for you?
My biggest issue is that I'm not especially convinced that Blood Moon is actually that good right now. Like, the prevalence of the Breach decks, and just, like, anytime you play a Sulphur Falls, your opponent knows what's up. And I just think fundamentally that's kind of problematic. Like, Blood Moon is really nice if your opponents aren't expecting it and don't play around it very well, but every time you play a Sulphur Falls or, like, fetch your second basic island, they pretty much
know. The gig is
up. Yeah, I also really don't like Lightning Bolt in these decks. It's probably a little bit better here than it is in the Emrakul decks.
It's definitely better in here than it is in the other decks.
It is, but, like, how much do you really want to try to win with Pestermite? Because if we're saying that Lightning Bolt is bad in the other deck but fine here, it's like, kind of, but the problem is that Lightning Bolt is not an especially good removal spell right now. And I think that your better Death Shadow opponents will likely be fairly good at, you know, not just putting themselves dead to Bolt Snap Bolt most of the time. So I worry that in, like, perhaps the most prevalent matchup, you are playing a removal spell that can't actually kill any creatures in their deck.
Which is one reason that you mentioned the want for more Harvest Pyre.
Right, but I just don't think you can play multiple Harvest Pyres. So, I mean, that's one of my kind of fundamental problems with this archetype. Like, your Death Shadow matchup, you're generally not very good against Thoughtseize with this style of deck, just because you're trying to sort of play a combo deck that requires you to spend a bunch of mana on your pieces. But then when you add the fact that you're playing removal spells that don't kill a Gurmag Angler or a Tassigur or generally a Death Shadow, it's just awkward.
Yeah. So for me, I think that this overarching strategy can sometimes be underutilized. Specifically, you know, Kiki-Jiki combos, I think, are a little bit underutilized, especially in a world with fewer lightning bolts. But that being said, I don't see this deck having really, really strong reasons to play it over, like, the teamer version of this deck. So for that reason, I think that if I was going to play a deck like this, I might do the teamer one. But also, I mean, you're the one that's playing this deck, and I think that you probably know things that I don't know at this point, right? Like, you have very specific one-ofs in here, and I like your one-ofs, so yeah, that's kind of where I'm at.
My only comment on that would be that I'm a little ambivalent about the, like, two main deck spell snare. That's definitely the most you can play, and it may well be one too many.
Oh, I thought those were spell pierce.
No.
Oh, I might actually play the second Harvest Spire or the second Spell Snare.
Yeah, I'm not. I mean, I'm not sure the third Electrolyze or the first Mana Leak or something. I mean, you have all kinds of choices, but, like, I have typically found that it is very, very hard to actually get value out of two Spell Snares in the same game.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. Yep. All right. Well, let's move on to our next segment. Thank you so much for was that. We are not going to do power rankings this week, because Magic is super boring right now, guys. Like, also, it was like double limited GPU weekend. We've just done Standard, Legacy, and Modern. Not much has changed because of where we're kind of at in the formats. But we are going to do our deck of the week that we missed last week, going over Lantern Control. So, Michael, you actually just qualified for a Pro Tour with Lantern Control.
Yeah, so Lantern is basically a deck that is trying to hide behind an ensnare and then use a combination of Codex Shredder, Pyxis of Pandemonium, and Lantern of Insight, three real all-stars, to keep your opponent from doing anything relevant for the rest of the game.
Yes. Anything relevant is the key there.
Yeah. I mean, it's you assemble this lock where basically by the end part of a game, you will generally get to deny your opponent say up to like two or three different draw steps a turn while still leaving one Pyxis or Codex Shredder back as a safety net. And in that, you can almost always just make it so that they will just draw lands, or if they don't have enough lands, they'll just draw spells.
So let's talk quickly about some of the key cards in the deck and some of the changes that happened that you picked up on relatively early. And the first one that I'd like to talk about is War of Invention.
Yeah, so War of Invention makes the deck more consistent. One of the issues with Lantern before was that you would sort of struggle to draw either Lantern of Insight or Ensnaring Bridge a lot, and you kind of need both for the deck to really function. So this changes some of the ways you have to build the deck. The mana is worse because of it, because you're trying to support a triple blue spell.
Yes.
And, like, to be totally honest, the mana is problematic sometimes, and one of the ways you can definitely lose is by drawing too many War of Inventions early in the game.
So, you talked about needing to draw Ensnaring Bridge. Why do you have to draw Ensnaring Bridge?
So, I mean, basically, you don't interact that well. You have some, like, Thoughtseizes, and you know, so you have some limited interaction, but mostly if your opponent goes like creature, 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 you know, goblin guide, goblin guide, goblin guide, or, you know, Tarmogoyf, 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 you don't have any way to actually really remove creatures, at least not a large number of them. So you pretty much have to get an Ensnaring Bridge in play or you will die.
So can you actually beat Goblin Guide into Double Guide with Ensnaring Bridge?
I mean, probably. You play a ton of zeros. Like, you can mostly have your hand gone by turn three on average, sometimes faster.
I'm, like, trying to think about it. So you go...
I mean, any hand that involves, like, Mox Opal, Mishra's Bauble can probably get there.
Okay.
Right, I mean, like, Thoughtseize, land, Opal. Like, because Opal enables you to play one drops.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
So where do you find, like, what are the key matchups for this deck that you really have to either worry about or are just really good for you?
Okay, so the worst matchup is, like, Green Tron. Green X Tron, by far. That is your worst matchup. Depending on how greedy you are when you build the deck, Burn can be not great, but I think if you are okay with playing some Collective Brutalities, that matchup's fine. The decks you really want to play against, probably like Humans, Storm, any deck that's trying to attack you to death.
Yeah, I've typically seen people be really happy about playing specifically against Tarmogoyf decks. Why don't you talk about that?
I mean, basically it's just like, if your opponent is trying to attack you and isn't playing a ton of interaction, like if they're not playing a bunch of Thoughtseizes or like Colligan's Commands or anything like that, they almost can't win. I mean, I think like Eldrazi Tron can get you when they Chalice on the play, but that matchup gets a lot better post-board because that's not really as likely to happen to you anymore. I think all of your control matchups are pretty good. I think basically, like, there are just a lot of decks that don't interact very well with the permanents you're putting into play. And when you're favored, you have enough control over both players' draw steps that, barring just kind of mulliganing into oblivion, very, very consistent.
This sideboard is pretty different than sideboards I've typically seen out of Lantern in the past. Why don't you talk about that for a second for me?
Let me see the exact sideboard. I mean, I know what I played at the RPTQ, but there's been a lot of stuff going on with sideboards.
Oh, I'm sorry. I actually thought that Mason just pulled your list up.
No, so this is... Kim Stro, but it looks pretty similar. So he's playing one more ley line than I was, but a lot of it is similar. So you have the third Pithing Needle. There are a lot of matchups where you want the third needle. It's like generally fairly obvious. Like just anytime that you're looking at like what they could have in their 75 and you're thinking, I need to actually be able to needle like at least two things, you probably want the third one. So a lot of the time I wouldn't bring it in if Pithing Needle is, it's mostly pretty obvious when Pithing Needle is good. It's just there are either things to Pithing Needle or there aren't.
Sure.
Right. I mean, if they have a bunch of Planeswalkers, Pithing Needle's great. If they have Engineered Ship Bomb or Karn or Walking Ballista or, so like against Eldrazi Tron, Pithing Needle's really powerful. So that comes in a lot in those matchups. Again, or like Affinity. It looks like there's a Porphyry. It's pretty powerful against most of the like creature decks in the format. It's really good against Noble Hierarch specifically, which is a card that this deck has traditionally struggled with. And then there's like Ley Lines. So those probably come in against Burn, but they can also come in against like heavier hand disruption. You might bring them in against Scapeshift, too. You have a Search for Iskanta for really grindy matchups, and then you sort of have Abrupt Decay, Ancient Grudge, and Maelstrom Pulse as a variety of things that are able to kill Chalice of the Void, but also other problematic permanents.
Why don't you talk to me really quick about periphery nodes? You kind of glossed over that one, and I know that was really powerful for you at the RPG itself.
So Noble Hierarch is really problematic because it is a zero-power creature that attacks for damage. So basically, even when you have no cards in hand, your opponent can attack you for damage through an Ensnaring Bridge. Now, you have ways to kill this in the main deck. There's like a single Pyrite Spell Bomb that you can recur with Academy Ruins. And often you're able to mill some of them, so your opponent is generally not going to like have all four Noble Hierarchs against you. But a Mana Dork that can attack, like if you take, they don't always need all four, right? Sometimes they only need to deal you like one extra point of damage, or they have a second one, so it gets exalted twice, or they have a Quasali Pride Mage, and even though you have double bridge, it is another exalted, something like that. So sure. Just some Noble Hierarch is traditionally one of the cards that has given this deck problems. So Periphery Nodes is a really sweet answer to that because it kills the creature with the lowest power at the beginning of your upkeep. And since Noble Hierarch has zero power, it always kills it first if you choose it. And basically the fact that it takes, like, none of the decks that play Noble Hierarch, there's no way for it not to be the lowest power creature on the battlefield. Like it takes really weird things
like a Spellskite or something.
No. It's like two Thalia's Lieutenants, usually. They're not usually playing Spellskite, so they usually have had to play like Noble, first Thalia's Lieutenant to make it one power, second Thalia's Lieutenant to make it two power.
I was thinking of something like Infect.
Yeah, so Infect doesn't see a whole lot of play anymore.
I just played against it twice in one league.
But I mean, I wouldn't say it's like the humans deck is the deck that I've played against most playing nobles. Sure. So it's really nice that you're generally able to choose it first, given that it's the creature that's usually giving you the most problems.
Oh, you get to choose.
You choose if it's a tie. So like even if they have another zero power, like if they had like a Devoted Druid, you could say, I don't care about your Devoted Druid. I need to kill your Noble Hierarch, or vice versa, depending on the board state and your life total or whatever. So that card's really powerful. And one of the cool things about this deck in general is that as the game goes really long, you can use Codex Shredder and Academy Ruins to like start buying things back from your graveyard if your opponent like won't concede or whatever and wants to keep playing because they think... So even if they end up with like another Noble somehow, you can have your Periphery Nodes die and get it back and kill their Noble again. So it's a really cute sideboard card. And a lot of the sideboard cards in this deck... I know it looks weird, but you can't actually sideboard that much. There's like a pretty big core that you have to leave intact. So a lot of these, despite being one ofs, like one is the most you could realistically side in a lot of the time.
Right. That makes a lot of sense, actually. Like when you think about one of the big problems with people, I feel like, is that they over sideboard. And this is one of those decks that you'll get really punished by doing that.
Yeah, like... So many of your cards, you're very reliant on synergies, and like you can't really cut too many artifacts. Your Mox Opals get worse. You can't cut your Mistress Baubles or your Mox Opals get worse. You can't cut your Mox Opals or your War of Inventions get worse. You have like this whole kind of hierarchical chain where you just are limited in the things you can cut. And that's fine, but it means that you probably can't. There are very few cards that you like really want to sideboard in three or four of.
Sure. Is there anything really important that you think that you should share about this deck for people who might want to pick it up?
I would say be aware of trying to have triple blue available to you. And then also be so that you can cast Whirr. Like, there are times where it might be correct to take a worse land over like one of your utility lands if it'll give you triple blue. Mm-hmm. So like even though Inventor's Fair might gain you life, it might be more important to have access to triple blue should you top deck War of Invention. And like, just not that that's always the case, but it's something to keep in mind. Other than that, I would say mostly keep in mind that you should just try to think about who you're Codex Shreddering and why. Because there are a lot of times where you should be milling yourself or your opponent, depending on the state of the game, and it's not always the same.
Sure. Right?
It can change turn to turn. So just try to evaluate before you're you know, getting really excited about milling either yourself or your opponent. Like, if they scry something at the top, you might want to mill that away, especially on a mulligan. Sometimes, like, you might make sort of an unintuitive play, and instead of, like, thought seizing them turn one, you might just lead on a Codex Shredder and just mill them in game one.
Sure.
So you could, there are all kinds of little things like that, but I think it's a deck that requires you to be careful and conscious of what's happening, but I don't think it's especially difficult to play.
Awesome. Well, that is it this week for Deck of the Week. Thank you so much, Michael, for sharing your insight into Lantern of Insight. Let's move on to our training grounds. Oh, come on. You give me crap for the Oasis Games thing, but you let that one slide.
I didn't catch what you
I said. Thanks.
Also, I think Spencer and I are switched on Twitch, which is very amusing.
Yeah, that's a, that, I mean, I'm just better looking this week.
Powerful.
Yeah. I said, thanks for your insight on Lantern of Insight, Michael.
Oh, man. Oh, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, man.
All right.
And now I'm watching on Twitch as our names are dragging around. It's great.
You know, it's really funny. Our podcast listeners have given feedback about kind of the live show and how it's detracted a little bit from the show. And I think that some of that is true. You know, if you ever have a problem with something that's going on the technical side, just tweet at Mason Clark. Like, let him know, and he will fix it.
I mean, to be fair, that was actually really funny. I don't know if you were watching as our names were dripping on the screen. It was great.
It is not the first time that this has happened. It's not the first time. Also, shout out to Mason.
I'm usually not paying that close of attention, apparently, but
yeah. Shout out to Mason. He's great. I'm just giving him a little bit of crap. Well, let's talk about our training grounds this week, which is getting your mana's worth. So this is voted on by our patrons. If you're a patron of the show, you get to vote. And we've actually just been doing it for basically every episode that's not a set review or a Pro Tour thing. Also, I won't say who. We might have a new reoccurring show where a member of Wizards staff comes and talks to us about Standard after the Pro Tour. I don't know who that could be that would be interested in coming on our show regularly, but they said that they probably wouldn't be that helpful until M19, because that's when their sets start. I don't know.
It's a mystery. We'll know in Magic 2019.
But this week, it's getting your mana's worth in the card. So one thing that I've always found super interesting in Magic is the idea of resource management. And there are a few points that I want to touch on with this. The first point that I want to touch on is understanding that you're investing something, right? All the mana that you have a return is a resource available, and you have to invest that resource in different ways to try and gain an advantage. So understand, even to the point of what you're trying to get out of your mana, I think is really important for you, for a base level to be like, why am I paying this mana? Why is this my investment? Because that's what it is. It's an investment, just like everything else.
Yeah, I think this gets particularly interesting when you have the choice between multiple spells. So multiple spells that perform a similar function but are slightly different. So you have to sort of decide between mana efficiency and saving the quote-unquote better spell, or yeah, like more flexible or more powerful spell. Because I think this is the kind of issue that comes up a lot in a game, and being able to effectively determine which resource is more valuable, like whether future flexibility or like mana efficiency is the more valuable resource.
And you know, you'll often hear people talk about their sequencing, right? Like, why did you play the spells in the order that you played them in? And it is a lot of it is risk management, right? It's like, well, I really want this spell to resolve. I think my opponent knows I have, and there's so many layers to it, right? It's like, I'm going to play this first to try and get a counter spell out of their hand or a removal spell out of their hand. I'm going to then enter my attack step, and then I'm going to, like, you just have all of these avenues that you can go down to try and either protect your investments, manage your risk and things like that. And I oftentimes wonder about a few things with this. So if I'm paying 4 mana for a creature, what do I want out of that creature? You know, one of the things that I see a lot of people do, they'll make a mistake with their Bristling Hydras, is they'll cast their Bristling Hydra before they have 3 energy, and it will die with the trigger on the stack. And I'll ask people, I'm like, well, why did you cast it there? They're like, oh, because it's really good in this matchup. I'm like, yeah, but like you had a Rogue Refiner that you could have cast, gotten to 3 energy, followed up with Bristling Hydra next turn, your Bristling Hydra would have taken over the game. Like, why did you cast the things in the order that you cast them and not protect your investment?
Right, and on the flip side, then, you may have something like the answer to that question may be that the Glorybringer you play next turn needs to kill their Chandra Torch of Defiance, and the only way you think you can get the Harnessed Lightning out of their hand is to play the Naked Bristling Hydra, right? So part of what I like about Magic a lot is that there are sort of all of these rules, right? Like, you would think, okay, well, I probably don't want to lose my Bristling Hydra for... I don't want to trade like my 4 mana creature for your 2 mana removal spell unless I do, right? Yeah. And that's where it starts getting interesting, right? That like we have all of these. You can play spells in any order, and I think more than saying this is the order you should play them in, the really cool takeaway is you get to decide as an active participant in the game why, right? It's not just.
It's not cut and dry, and that's one of the things about Magic is that, you know, I talked about all of the layers behind how you resolve your spells in what order, but it all starts in the mana you're putting into them. You know, Michael just talked about trading your Bristling Hydra for a Harnessed Lightning. You know, if so on Michael's point, right, like if you're trying to get your 5 mana haste creature in, right? That might be something that you're willing to do to try and protect that investment later, right? But on the flip side, if you're not trying to do that, they're trading 2 mana for 4 mana. A huge tempo swing.
Right. Right. And then from their side, you know, they might have multiple spells. So they might have an Abrade and a Harnessed Lightning, right? And they might be trying to decide whether they should Abrade your 3-drop or Harnessed Lightning it, right? And like, you know, say it's just a Rogue Refiner, right? So either one's going to kill it, but they might be looking at like a multitude of factors, right? If you're playing an energy mirror, they might say, well, this is going to make my Bristling Hydra come in with enough energy to save it if I have like one left over from killing a Servant or a Rogue Refiner. So that might be something they're weighing, but they also might say, oh, well, maybe he's, you know, this Harnessed Lightning will age better than the Abrade because it can hypothetically do more than 3 damage. But they also might say, oh, but maybe my opponent's playing Sky Sovereign. Right. So you have to sort of look for contextual cues in the game to figure out like why you might play one spell over another. And again, there's very rarely something that's strictly right or wrong. It's a lot of gray.
Absolutely. It's too hard. I mean, Magic has what, 14,000 unique cards? You know, Standard often has
even in
hundreds.
Standard it's just mostly combinations about the hidden information inherent in the game, right? Like, you're just not going to know your opponent's full 75.
Yeah, there's too many combinations that they could have, and there's just too many different opportunities throughout a game to make a decision for you to just always... for something to always be correct, right? And, you know, I think that we kind of already touched on this, so maybe we'll just go into this a little bit and work our way back. But I think that one thing that people often don't understand about getting your mana's worth is understanding tempo. So there was a video done by Evan Irwin and Brad Nelson they might have asked for a Snapcast ban before the next set came out when Delver was dominant in Standard. It was something along the lines of like, the only real loss we have is what's the 1 mana unsummoned deal one?
Vaber Snag.
They're like, the only real loss is Vaber Snag, and we still have Unsummon. And it was so funny to look back on that because it seemed so reasonable. It was like, yeah, like this tempo deck is just going to take over. And I think that oftentimes we get confused between tempo and power. People think that tempo is the most powerful thing all the time. But I actually think that there's a lot of the times you have to think of, like, what kind of downside to power am I getting for playing this cheaper spell?
The shorter the games are, the more powerful tempo is, right? If you play a lot of Eternal formats, I think, like, in Legacy especially, like, if you're playing a format dominated by, like, Days and Wasteland, yes, tempo is extremely important, and spending your mana in the most efficient, safe way is, like, you know, really... But when you're playing these games that are stretching out 8, 10, 12 turns all the time, it's...
It doesn't matter as much.
It doesn't card advantage. Raw card advantage matters more, and sometimes keeping your options open matters more. I mean, I spent a bunch of this standard playing a deck with Fatal Push, Harnessed Lightning, and Vraska's Contempt as its three main removals, and just this really speaks to me because of that. Because so much of the time you'd be sort of like, okay, so I can decide between making a play that is more mana efficient and gives me less flexibility in the future, right? Like, I can spend 4 mana to Vraska's Contempt something now, and if they play a Planeswalker, I'm going to be sad that this Fatal Push is in my hand. But if I draw a 5-drop, I might be sad that this Vraska's Contempt is in my hand because, you know, now I can't play them both in the same turn. So just trying to figure out where the trade-off points are for that is extremely interesting.
And I think that, you know, the there's so many... I actually didn't realize how big this topic was. but, you know, one of the things that you think about, like you kind of just said it, is, you know, what am I willing to pay for a removal spell, for example? And I like to combine this for, like, what am I willing to pay for a draw spell? Like, is this format about... Can I, in this format, is 3 mana invested to draw 2 cards an investment that I can make? In this format, is 4 mana to point and click a removal spell an investment that I can make?
Right.
And you have to... Go ahead.
Yeah, just you're almost always trying kind of tempo for flexibility, right? That's like, that's usually the trade-off. The cheaper something is, it's often very good at one specific thing, but it's not as flexible a card. Just the more you're paying for cards, generally, the more flexible they're going to be. Flexible or powerful, one or the other. Right? So you're always trying to sort of figure out, like, when you go to draw spells, I think a lot of the time what you're really asking is, like, what is the least I can do in this format? When do my first actions in a game have to be? Right? Like, how long can I basically play completely reactive magic, not really from the board, you know, maybe play a simple, like, where's the turn in the game where I have to be committing things to the board?
I mean, if you think about something like some of the, like, huge draw spells that we've had in the past, right, for standard specifically, so you think about something like, I mean, all the way back to Stroke of Genius, Sphinx's Revelation, those are, like, big X spells, right, where, like, you're drawing X cards, and then you even have things like Dig Through Time, right? Where maybe your investment is hidden. Maybe getting your mana's worth is hidden in different ways, right? Where it's like a deck building cost. I mean, if I told you you're going to play blue-blue, look at the top 8 cards of your deck and pick 2, at instant speed, you would say 100 times out of 100. And we'll take that one.
Yep.
Yeah, I'll take it, right?
Double impulse. Yeah, that seems good.
But had you asked me when either Vraska's Contempt or Hero's Downfall was a card, right? And you would, like, were spoiled and you were like, hey, do you want to pay this much to point and click your removal spell? I'd have been like, no. Give me back my Lightning Bolts and Doom Blades, weirdo.
I distinctly remember feeling like Vraska's Contempt would be most comparable to Utter End. And I think it's substantially better than that.
It is significantly better Utter End. But it, like we said earlier, right? You have to understand what investments are worth it at one point and what you can afford in a format. Because we're in a format of Hazoret, all of a sudden Vraska's Contempt is like, I can't not afford to make this investment. It's
like, it might actually just be better than Hero's Downfall in this format straight up.
Yeah, because...
Which is weird, right? You'd say it's probably a worse card.
Yeah, it's definitely a worse card, but this is the world that you're in, and you're the kind of things that you can spend mana on and getting your mana's worth. You are willing to pay that extra mana, right? The extra mana is worth it, right? We're talking about getting your mana's worth. And the extra mana is worth it to get rid of Hazoret for good.
Right. Well, to get rid of Hazoret at all. I mean, that's the problem, right? Most of your other removal spells probably don't kill him under any condition.
Exactly.
So, I think that just like a lot of this comes down to sort of understanding matchups too. Like there are some matchups where you have to be a lot more concerned about spending all your mana, and tempo is just a lot more important. Basically, the shorter you expect the game to be, the more important tempo is over maximizing card advantage. Like against mono red, a lot of the time what I think about is trying to sort of be as or more efficient than them, especially in sideboarded games.
Well,
but trying
you have to, their deck is built around like getting the most out of their mana, right?
Right. So you have to sort of play that style of game with them, right? If you're trying to cast, you know, big haymakers against them, it's really hard to beat mono red by casting Glimmer of Genius and Torrential Gearhulk. Now, if you're playing against Team or Energy, those are really good magic cards because you know the game is going to go longer. You know you won't be punished as much for not spending your mana in the first few turns.
Yeah, I think that, you know, when you think about, like, the spots in your curve against a deck like Mono Red, like, that's actually a thing that you think about. Whereas when you think about, like, maybe not the Team or Mirror, that it still matters there, right? But there are other matchups where you'd be like, well, this, like, I'm not going to fill, like, jam this now to gain a tempo edge, right? Where against other decks, you're like, I need to jam this now to not lose out on tempo.
Right. Well, a lot of the times, basically in a long enough game, you're never going, mana isn't a constraint, right? Like, we can sort of, by going to an extreme example, in an infinitely long game, mana is not a constraint.
Then you just have all the mana, right? Yeah.
Right? And in a, you know, in a five-turn game, or like, you know, a four-turn game, mana is incredibly critical, and being the most mana efficient you can possibly be is basically the only thing that matters. Like, card advantage doesn't mean anything if you're going to be dead on turn four.
So I'd like to kind of dive into getting your mana's worth in the world that you just described, right? So if I go to 15 turns, the maximum number of mana that I can have is one drop, like one mana, two mana, three mana, four mana, five mana, up all the way to 15, right?
Sure.
Right? If I play a land every turn. Sounds like you got
sure.
a little unlucky there, but like that's the most mana that you can have. In a four turn game.
I mean, if you're
game,
playing a 15 drop, it sounds good.
Yeah. in a four turn or a five turn game, right? A lot of games might go to turn six, right? You actually don't have that much mana. Like,
right.
It's one mana, then two mana, then three mana, then four, all the way up to six if you hit all your land drops. And often,
right.
You're not going to hit all your land drops up till turn six.
Right. The basic difference, like, fundamentally, is that each mana you don't spend in a shorter game as a percentage is greater.
Yes.
So it's going to be more impactful, and that's why in a shorter game it matters so much more. Like, Fatal Push is going to be better than Confiscation Coup in a game that goes till turn five, right? Like,
yeah, even though you can cast that Confiscation Coup, but the problem is if the game's only going that long, did that Confiscation Coup matter?
Well, I mean, I guess more than, that's an unfair way to say things. In a deck that is trying to end the game on turn five, both playing with and against you want more one drops.
Sure.
Than
what,
right?
What I'm saying is that when you play against a deck that's trying to end the game quickly, even if you get to cast your very powerful five mana spell that you're happy investing mana in, it might be the incorrect way to invest your mana.
Right.
The way that the other deck has dictated the game.
It might be too great a percentage of your total mana in this game.
To invest into one card.
Right, exactly. Exactly, that card really has to get you a lot of mileage to be worth it at that point. Where I think that, like, if you can understand tempo like that, right? Tempo is very powerful in short games and almost in very long games, right? Like, tap lands don't matter in control mirrors. Not really.
Sure.
Right? Because I'm not really trying to play one or two drops anyways. It just isn't really a thing. So I think that when you look at a lot of, like, when you look at expensive that are designed to be played in short games, or if you're trying to figure out how to cast them in short games when tempo is important, I think it's just making sure that you're not trying to always hold them for better targets. Like something like Vraska's Contempt, sometimes against mono red it has to target like an Oncrop Crasher. It just, you know, or you're going to die because you will have wasted too much mana trying to wait for a better target. I think just understanding sort of when to cut bait with some of these more expensive cards can really increase your win percentage.
Yeah, I think that understanding, giving, like, so often on this podcast, we talk about why you made the decision, right? And this is the most basic why you can get to. Why am I spending my mana? And what am I getting out of that mana? And what does my game look like if I make this decision and invest my mana here?
Yeah, and I think that this then, figuring out how to balance this in different matchups, because a lot of the time you will lose by sort of blinking first if in a matchup that goes longer. Like, even playing Virtuoso and that being the first one to play it can be really good because you can pressure them in the air, but it can also be very bad in that your opponent may be able to kill, like, even if you had six energy already, you're only going to be able to make two Thopters if your opponent can kill it with a trigger on the stack. Whereas if theirs comes out four or five turns later and they have, you know, 15 or 16 or 17 energy, right, even if you can kill it, it's providing substantial value. So I think a lot of the time just understanding, like, how long is this game going to go? How much, not only how much tempo advantage, how much card advantage do I need this card to turn into to have a chance at winning this game?
Right.
Is what really is, interesting and important.
Like, if I'm going to spend, I think that you kind of really encapsulated this with your comment about, or with, I guess, our combined comment about, you know, stealing your opponent's creature, right? It's like, I can spend that five mana to do that, right? But, like, where does that get me in the next three turns, or the next turn, or the next two turns? Like, what did this five mana get me? And had I just played a Rogue Refiner and abraded the creature, what would that have gotten me? Would it, like, for example, could it have gotten me three extra turns to take over this game? Could, or does me stealing that creature actually end this game in two turns, right?
Well, or maybe what does that spell mean in different matchups, right? Like,
right.
Because something like Confiscation Coup is, or like Glorybringer, I think both those are really good examples. They don't mean the same thing in different matchups, right? Like, Glorybringer in some matchups might mean it killed your opponent's Whirler Virtuoso and their Chandra.
Right.
But against Mono Red, Confiscation Coup might mean you got a tapped Rampaging Ferocidon, right? Like, that didn't do you basically any good.
Actually, I mean, even if you look at something like Confiscation Coup, right, where it's like you're like, okay, I'm going to take this Rogue Refiner because, like, I have five mana and I want to be mana. I want to spend all my mana every turn, right?
Right.
And then they're like, okay, untap, play Scarab God. And you're like, yeah. Oh, man, you know, I did have an Abrade and a Rogue Refiner of my own, and I could have just left up Abrade for,
Or you didn't have anything, but you just had to make your Confiscation Coup worth more than that because the only way you could have possibly won this game was to get that card.
Yes.
Right? I mean, it's not always about having better options, like, in the
short
term.
Sometimes it's just about,
I can't win a game with my next play. It doesn't matter. Maybe I don't win very many games where I just get, you know, take 12 from this Rogue Refiner or whatever.
Well,
but having the foresight to say, my opponent too many cards for me.
Yeah.
Like, me holding back mana here and not playing a spell is making them read me for Confiscation Coup, but the only way I can win this game is to not cast it, because if I cast it, I'm just going to get Scarab God or Glorybringer or whatever.
So it's winter in Utah right now, so I hope that you guys got to hear everything that Michael's been saying this episode. I know that he's been breaking up a little bit, but Michael, if there's anything, any bit of advice you can give to people for understanding how to spend their mana and make sure they get the most out of it, what would that bit of advice be?
I think it's pretty, like, what makes it interesting is that it's never cut and dry. But what you have to do is sort of consider, okay, if I don't play anything or I choose to make the less mana efficient play, what can happen that would make me regret this, and vice versa. If I make the more mana efficient, but maybe, like, slightly settling play, because that's a lot of the time what it comes down to, you'll play a card that you're not using to maximum efficiency in order to use your mana more efficiently. How can I be punished for this? And I think just trying to think through what might happen when you have multiple decisions, like when you have a decision that branches pretty hard, just trying to think through And then when you play a game, go back and take note of where you made these decisions. And over time, you'll get better and better and better at making them. Your intuition for that kind of stuff will improve. And that's the biggest thing, right? I mean, you're not going to be able to, like, whip out an Excel sheet and be like, well, if I make this play statistic, like, it's going to have to be mostly intuition, right?
Sure. So that is it for this week's Training Grounds. Thank you so much to our patrons for voting on this one. We'll do the one that took second place in this poll next week. Actually, how close is it to Goodbye? I guess it's not. Does the set not come out until February?
No, the Pro Tour is the first week, I think. So,
okay, so would it come out like a little bit before that? Okay.
Mid. It should come out in like a month.
Okay. Cool. Alright. Alright. Well, I think then we will do the second place from that poll next week. You're still welcome to vote on that. We'll keep it open for 2 weeks. Whatever place they come in. Don't vote on this one because we already did it, so that'd be kind of a wasted vote. But whatever you want between the other two options, please vote. And if you're a patron, patreon.com/ccmtg. Speaking of which, thank you to everybody who has been a patron. I'm really excited to make these changes. I've gotten feedback from a lot of people. One change I'm pretty confident that we're going to make is about Card of the Week. Part of the problem with Card of the Week has been logistics, and that's why we've stopped. And I think I found a solution to it. And it's a really sweet solution if you're a patron. So stay tuned for that. Right now, as it stands, you just need a patron of $3 or more per month. And basically, we will send out Card of the Week to the people who win it as a giveaway. Stay tuned for updates on that, because I think I found a solution that works for me and will work even better for our patrons to give them the most value. So where to find us? Michael, where can people find you?
You can find me on Facebook. My name is Michael Hinderocker. You can also find me on Twitter at MagicMikeMTG.
You can find me on Facebook at Spencer Stephen Howland. You can find me on Twitter at Spencer13H. You can find me in the Constructive Criticism family on Facebook. If you're a patron of $5 more, you can find me in the Constructive Critics group. You can find me on MTGO at Spencer13Dev, where you can ask to join the clan. You can also message Earthstripe, that's URTHSTRYPE. You can find Mason, our technical producer, at Mason Clark. I asked Mason why he chose that name. I said I thought it was interesting that he didn't use Austin Geltz as his Twitter handle. I just think that, you know, you should use your real name if you're going to use your name. You can find this podcast every week on mtgcast.com, constructivecriticism.com. I really enjoyed this week's episode, Michael, so I just wanted to say thank you for that.
Yeah, I think it was an interesting topic.
I actually think we could have gone like 40 more minutes on it, but I felt like we would start saying the same things.
Yeah, it's just, it's hard sometimes not to get a little bit sidetracked with, like, it's hard to know what you'll think until you start talking sometimes. That's basically what I would say for anyone who doesn't have experience with that.
We could write a script where, and we've done it before. So back when Manny and Casey were my co-hosts, we actually would write down literally our thoughts on each point before doing it. And it was really good for like the flow of the show, and it kept it at a concise length. But I know that a lot of our listeners really value Michael kind of just going off into Michael land, and patent pending.
So yeah, I mean, it can be good or bad, but I think that sometimes we're able to sort of bridge into topics where, like, I don't think either of us would get there on our own in brainstorming.
Yeah.
But when you actually start jumping into it, something that Spencer says or something that Spencer says triggers me, or something that I say triggers Spencer, and like, we kind of get into a deeper, more interesting place than I had thought we might.
Yeah, it was a very fun topic for me this week, so thank you so much. You can join the conversation in Discord if you go to our bios or our info page. Anyway, there's a link on the website to the Discord. We would love it if people could test on Discord together, help each other improve. That is what that is for. I'd be happy to get any feedback about that. But you can also tweet at us with hashtag WithoutBeGood. Hashtag WithoutBeGood is our Twitter outreach program. If you tweet up, Michael will read it. That is how it works. Michael, whoa. What is the first one?
Changed. Well, now I have to look it up because I didn't have it pulled up.
Is it bad manners as a lantern? Is it bad manners as a lantern player to wish my opponents good luck since my deck actively seeks to attack their luck?
I mean, no. I think you always. I like to wish my opponents good luck, because what I think that really means is I'm saying I hope we get to play real games of Magic, right? I hope neither of us mulligan to four, and, you know, it's just not that interesting, right? Like, right. I always wish my opponents good luck. They almost always say it back, too.
All right. They almost always do. I had a player who refused to shake my hand when I beat him in a top eight. He was like,
"That's aggressive."
No. He was like, I like put up my hand. He's like, "No, man, like, no." And like, we've played each other a lot. In fact, we had played each other in the PPTQ before this, and he had called a judge on a life total discrepancy demanding that I didn't block with a creature that I just had a free block with. And I was like, I was like, judge, like, I clearly have the creature in play. We both say that it was in play when he attacked. Like, he, I don't know. Some people are just weird, man.
It's just like, ultimately, you never know who you would like to, like, talk to in the future, who you might need a favor from, who...
Manny, I was just kidding. I'm totally going to start your dryer.
Who might,
that's so...
you know, be in a position to do something nice for you, and just going out of your way to torpedo people's feelings about you is just really aggressive. Like,
Manny,
you can do it,
the
but there's a cost.
Really sorry. Manny turned on the dryer, and I'm really sorry. All right. Well, that's good. Mason says you can't hear it. All right. This has been one of the string of 5 to 6. This has been one of the strings.
I assume it's one of the best strings of 4 to 6.
Oh, okay.
Ever between me and Holy Tornadoes, winning PPTQs, to cheering on friends and other Magic endeavors. Was on holiday break now, to the whole country going Roll Tide. This is just plain great. #. Would that be good? #. Step in the right direction.
There you go. Congratulations.
Magic Adrian gotten... after says, "I'm just mad about the typo in this."
Oh, that's even better, because I like legitimately was confused.
Yeah.
Magic has gotten better for me since I noticed what taste people in their basic land choice. And I came to notice what taste people in their basic... Double typos, Adrian. Double typos. Okay.
Yeah, I know what he's trying to say. It just means that looking at basic lands is kind of fun.
So I have decided that I will be switching to the unstable lands. And I will be using all of my store credit for my sponsorships to be switching. They're so pretty, dude.
I like the... So I have a bunch of them in paper, because I already bought a bunch of them from Fusion.
Oh, did you do it? That's what I'm going to do!
Yeah. They're already in my possession, so I did that, like, you know, a week and a half ago.
How many did you get?
I will say... I don't know. Not a ton. It's like 10 of each, roughly.
I was going to get 20 of each.
Yeah, 20 is, like... definitely as many as you need. What I would say ultimately is, like, the forest and swamp are great. The plains is next after that, then the island, and the mountain is in the doghouse. The mountain is terrible.
So it's so funny, because I haven't wanted to switch basic lands, but I really like the Amonkhet full arts. I think the Hour of Devastation swamp is better than the Amonkhet swamp. So. Okay.
But, the unstable swamp is insane. The
is
swamp
it?
And the forest are, like, legitimately great.
I mean, the island looks really, really great from the one I've seen.
It's okay. It's a little bit, like, I wish there were more colors in it. Like, I understand why they didn't do it that way, but it's very blue.
All right, let's. All right, Michael. This has to happen. Give me your basic lands power rankings.
Okay. How many do you need?
I want your top three sets. Not individual lands, but like you have to use the same set for all your basics. What are your top three?
Number one, Arena 2003. Number two, APAC. Number three, Euro.
Okay. So My last place is Guru, because if you spend that much of basic lands, you're a psychopath.
I mean, if you have them, or if it doesn't matter, then, you know, more power to you. But, yeah. So
my number one is Unglued. I really, really like the frame and the symbol. My number two is probably... It's probably Unstable now. And then my number three is... Zendikar. And here's the thing, is I like full art lands. Like, I understand the love of beta lands, and like, they are pretty. They look like, when they're sleeved up, like, they look sweet.
Yeah, it's hard to find them in good enough condition, though. I think this is true of a lot of the duels too. People play like ridiculously beat beta duels and they look really bad.
Yeah. So for me, I think those are my top three. I really like the original Zendikar frame, and I really like the Unglued frame. Like, a lot. That symbol on the Unglued frame is just sweet, dude.
Yeah.
All right. There you go. We gave our basic lands power ranking, you know, because everybody cares so much about them. Man, Shrieking Affliction has really gone up. Hashtag with it be good. Yeah, so just so everybody knows, there is a bug on Oasis Games website that...
It's not a bug. It does this when the price is changing really quickly to try to not get bought out of things.
Oh, is it a feature?
But sometimes it goes a little haywire and does it on things that just, like, had some variance naturally. So we have to change it back. But it is listing Shrieking Affliction foils at, you know, $1,000 a piece. Yeah, but that specific price is like a flag that the system has changed it.
Yep. You can call Oasis and they'll adjust it for you, just so you know. So don't ever feel like they don't want you to buy the cards. But just call them and they'll fix it. Just a heads up.
Yeah. Or watching, shoot enter a Facebook message or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, all of them. Shoot all of them to Michael, specifically. Your face there was great.
Yeah. It's like, don't really do that. I mean, I guess, Mason, if you want to message me, I can probably, you know, fix that stuff for you.
Watching Enter the Battlefield again on Netflix, the first line by Rude Duke is so important to me. You know, have you seen this? Also,
yeah, I actually know what line that is off the top of my head, which is surprising to me.
No, it is, if you have ever wanted to shine in Magic, that line is like...
Or be good at anything.
Yeah, it's just like...
It gives me chills.
He says, One day I just decided I wanted to be one of the best. I didn't want to just be your local grinder. I wanted to compete at the highest level. And it was... He made a conscious decision. And I love the line. I have, by the way, not made that decision in my life. Like, I have no intention of being, like, Reduke, for example. But The chilling is the right word. It's like you were serious. Like, you made a conscious decision to be one of the best in the world, and he meant it, right? Like, if I said I did a series about how to improve at Magic, and part of how to improve at Magic is making the decision to improve at Magic. A lot of people, like, say they want to get better, but they don't actually do the things that you have to do to improve. That's just getting better. What Reed is saying is, I didn't just make the decision to be good, right? I made the decision that I was going to do everything I could to be one of the best players ever.
So, I mean, I think that, like, that line maybe gets a little over-dramatized just because Reed has actually been so good. But what I think of it like this. So Reed was already, probably when he made that decision, quite a good player.
He was probably
winning
already,
local events.
Yeah, exactly.
Winning local events, like, he's good. He's, like, you know, winning locally, maybe playing some regional events and doing pretty well. But just, like, I think that making the conscious decision to be like, you know, it's not that I'm bad at this. It's that I know that I will not be satisfied with this level of effort. And thinking, oh, maybe if I tried harder, I could have been better. Just like, I'm not going to let my effort level get in the way of me being better at this than I am right now.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Why did that line stick out to you?
Just because it's like, I like the idea of it's inspiring to think just of trying to be as good at something as you can possibly be. I mean, now there are a lot of things you could try to be really good at that you would probably never be as good at as Reed Duke is at Magic. But I think that just like from an attitude standpoint, obviously I'd love to emulate Reed Duke in terms of being as good at Magic as he is, but I think that anyone can emulate that attitude in anything they do, and that's kind of inspiring.
I don't know if I talked about it on this podcast. I definitely talked about it in Limited Emily. So I won the first PBDQ of this season in Limited, and I took top four the one the weekend before that in Limited. And before that PBDQ, I said I had watched Reed play in a Grand Prix. And I had said, my goal this weekend is to use the exact word that Michael just said. I want to emulate Reed Duke. I want to think about decisions the way that I see him doing it. And one of the things that this line really spoke to me, and if you watch Reed Duke play, you see exactly what he's saying. He made a conscious effort. And every time he makes a play in Magic, he's making a conscious effort. And first of all, I don't have the mental capacity to do what he does. But secondly, I found it so inspiring that somebody could just say, I'm going to do this. I'm going to make this decision, because they're taking ownership and they're saying they're not allowing the times that they lose or the times that things get rough for them or anything like that to dictate how they perceive themselves or how others perceive them in the game. They're going to do everything within their control to be one of the best players in the world. And, you know, obviously with Enter the Battlefield, you see Reed Duke top 8 his first pro tour and things like that. It's intense, but I hope that everybody that's listening knows that it is within your power to get better, but you can't just say you want to get better. You can't just say, I'm going to listen to a podcast or read an article and then I'll be better. That's not how it works. You have to actually put in the work. It's not about saying you're doing it. It's not about wanting to do it. Wanting to do it is the first step. You have to execute on that after that. And we've all, if you've been playing Magic for the last few years, we all watched Reed Duke take last place at Worlds after being the Modo champion. And then turning that into a Platinum year, taking second place at Worlds. I mean, we've watched him make this mental decision and change his life. And I don't know.
Right, it's really inspiring. Obviously he was, really good before that.
Right, he got to Worlds.
I mean, that's the thing, right? This isn't...
Yes.
It's it's nice because it lets you know that there are always things you can do to improve. Yeah. And that's the only way to get better, right? To, keep looking for ways to improve the things you're not good at.
Dirk Gently is amazing. It will be on Netflix January 5th. Watch it. The show needs a third season. Up to My Knees does some really crazy and cool stuff with the show. Hashtag would that be good. Hashtag save Dirk Gently. All right.
I don't know that, but if Mason's that excited about it, I will watch some of it. I will at least give it a chance for Mason's sake.
Michael, thank you so much for this week. I really had a good time.
Yeah, it was fun. I like the patrons choosing the topic. I think it both takes a little bit of pressure off of you in terms of just trying to come up with something that you're interested to talk. It just can be hard sometimes to brainstorm something up that you're really excited about.
It's really interested to be interested in the thing that they're interested in.
Well. The thing is that, I mean, they play Magic. They mostly vote for things that they are interested in. And if they find it interesting, it's usually because it's, unsurprisingly, a relatively interesting subject, right? They're not voting for, how would you prefer to spell dog? Right? I mean, they're voting for things they want to hear about. And they want to hear about it because it's something that's challenging or difficult or whatever. And I think that it just generally makes for, it makes for good shows, and hopefully that that comes across.
Michael, what did you learn this week?
Well, I learned that Mason can't spell Shrieking Affliction because in his screenshot, he searched for Shrike. So, you know, if he's going to call out pricing, I'm gonna call out everything.
He also spelled it
he
wrong.
Also,
in
he
his
called
tweet.
It Shrinking Affliction. So, man, we have.
So there are
many ways to spell Shrieking Affliction.
So good. I learned that. I just love doing this podcast, guys. Thank you. Thank you so much to all of our patrons. Thank you so much to all of our listeners. You know, it's been a rough month or two for me, and this show really does help me. And this week, you know, being able to just, I literally forgot where I was until Manny turned the dryer on. Like, I just got to talk about magic, and it was really great. So thank you to Michael. Thank you to Mason. Don't forget to check out our other shows on the network. You know, you have Limited Time Only, which we didn't do last week because Danny apparently forgot his charger for his laptop.
I mean, yeah, we're also getting to kind of a rough spot in the limited format, I would imagine, right?
Well, we were going to do the goodbye. We were going to do the goodbye episode, like just say, forget it. Like, just say goodbye to this set already.
Yeah.
But, you know, I do that show with Danny Cathro. He's a Silver Pro GP Top 8 competitor in Legacy. Real strong Legacy
somehow.
Contender. Real strong Legacy player. He's Top 8, bro. Top 8. He's got the secret tech on the lands you should play. Don't you know? I actually couldn't say it with a straight face.
When you borrow the deck from your roommate, sometimes you get what you get. Right?
It's funny. I loved his roommate telling that story at dinner where he's like, I'm reading Reddit posts and people are literally debating why Danny's playing the lands he has. And so finally I break the glass and I'm like, well, it's because I loaned him the deck and only had three.
Yeah. I think that it's supposed to be like a 3-3 split and he was playing like 4 Ancient Tomb, 2 City. Like, well, the actual reason for this is because City of Traders is, you know, $150 and Ancient Tombs are $20. Really powerful.
You can listen to the return of Common Knowledge. We got raving, amazing reviews. If you are into Pauper, I really like what Brandon and Raphael are bringing to this podcast. They're really excited. I'm producing this show, being a part of it with them, doing some of the things that I really loved about constructive criticism early, and really helping mold a show and build it to be what it can be. So if you like the shows I produce, I am producing that one. And then we are hosting Proven Combatants, which is a show hosted by female Magic players, just some amazing girls trying to get better, trying to qualify for the Pro Tour.
They're really talented. They are really talented players.
We got, I think, is it three of the four of them have gone to the Pro Tour?
And Autumn is the current national,
yeah, the
national champion.
Yeah, I was going to say, and then Autumn is the national champion of England. So just some really talented girls. Chantel's going to get to the Pro Tour, you know, next weekend or something because she's amazing. it's I really like where we're at. We also just added Jake Tilk. We'll be hosting his YouTube videos on our website. So check in for updates on Jake and the things he's doing. We've talked about his decks on the show before.
He's had a lot of good results lately.
Yeah. So, and he's going to get to the Pro Tour really soon too. And then we have Alex K doing the finance content. So the site is, I don't know what happened. But I'm really happy with where we're at, and I just want to thank everybody for listening, be part of this. It means the world to me. And this week I learned that I could talk about this for way too long. So we'll see you guys all next week.
Thanks for listening.